I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, our guest today is Kendra Kaiser. She's the director of the Idaho Water Resources Research Institute, and she's also assistant professor at the University of Idaho. Peter, today we're talking about water in Idaho. I think this is one of our favorite topics because we come back to water all the time because it's so darn important in our state.
It is so important, and we are not at the point where we have water everywhere.
We've got water sometimes.
Yeah.
Will we have water when we need it?
That's the key question.
We're going to dig into that and a whole lot. But first, you've got nature in the news.
Yeah, I've got some really great news, Leif. Generative AI systems have reached a new level where they can outperform average humans on certain creativity measures.
Was that you saying that or was AI saying that?
Well,
I'm getting meta here.
It was Google AI that told me it, so I believe it.
Okay, so, tell me about the wonders of AI.
So researchers from the University of Montreal evaluated multiple AI systems, including ChatGPT, Claude, I've never heard of that one.
I use Claude.
Okay, and Gemini, and compared their performance against over 100,000 human participants. Okay. So some of the AI systems, including GPT-4, exceeded average human scores on tasks designed to measure divergent linguistic creativity.
Divergent linguistic creativity.
Yes.
What on earth is that?
So the research team used the Divergent Association Task, DAT, which measures divergent creativity by testing the ability to generate diverse and original ideas from a single prompt. Okay. So for this experiment, human and AI were asked to list 10 words that are as unrelated in meaning as possible.
All right.
And then after that was all done, they were tasked on creative writing challenges, including simple challenges, in a sense, short challenges, including writing haikus, movie plot summaries, and short stories. So throughout the test, a pattern developed where AI sometimes exceeded the performance of average humans, but they weren't close to the most skilled human creators. So, you know, those who have, quote, average creativity, the AI could overtake. But when you've got some really creative thinkers, artists, writers, et cetera, they weren't even close.
Well, I guess that's a good thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that means there's one, there's still a place for humans.
Yep.
And the ones that excel, the humans that excel in a particular creative domain, mm-hmm. at least now, yep. as of now, are not being surpassed by the robots.
Yes. So I personally think within our school systems, we need to focus in on humanities, art classes.
Oh, I like it.
Music, and I would say even shop classes, you know, especially shop classes where you're not programming computers or laser printers, but you're designing and creating things by your own hands.
Well, I like this. This is good news.
Yeah.
AI can help us. I'm trying to be a positive person about AI and seeing where, you know, in my life it can make things a little faster, easier for the kind of basic work.
Yeah, I think we should look at it as kind of a tool.
Sure.
As something that can benefit us.
Yeah.
But something that we should not rely on.
I'm with you right there. Okay. Can it make more water? Ooh. Think about that. I don't know. Maybe I'll ask our guest that. Maybe I won't do that. Our trivia question for today has to do with water. And this is a fun little fact I think you'll enjoy. What day of the year is the start of the water year? There is a beginning. When we come back from the break, Kendra Kaiser is going to join us. She's going to answer that question, but she's going to tell us a whole lot more about water in Idaho and where we're at today. Why don't you stay tuned? We'll be back from the break in a sec.
Did you miss the latest edition of The Nature of Idaho or ISU's Research, Innovation, and Creativity Insights? Sometimes it's tough to hear your favorite KISU shows live, but you can listen to them on demand with our free KISU mobile app for your Apple or Android device. Search your app store for KISU to get started.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome our guest back for a second time. Our guest today is Kendra Kaiser. She was with us a few years ago. She's the director now of the Idaho Water Resources Research Institute and also assistant professor at the University of Idaho. That's a mouthful. Welcome back, Kendra.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Okay, since you were with us last time, you have gained a new title. You are now director of the Idaho Water Resources Research Institute. Tell us what that institute does.
Yeah, for sure. We call it IWERI for short, a little bit less of a mouthful.
Right.
And IWERI's mission is to address state, regional, and national water issues by conducting critical research needs that support water resource managers and water users across the state, in the Northwest region, and nationally, sharing current information and supporting the development of a multidisciplinary water workforce. So we are actually one of 54 WERIs across the country. There's one in every state and territory, and we were established by an act of Congress in 1964. And so at the time, the federal government recognized that in order to address local resource needs, you need a local research entity that can help coordinate across different stakeholders, coordinate across the universities. And really, that was an effective mechanism to drive locally relevant work. So here in Idaho, we're doing just that. We are building relationships across the universities, across different state agencies, working with our federal colleagues, and really engaging with stakeholders to identify what the priorities are right here in our backyard.
So you're just not sitting in your office. You're going out and communicating to people because, you know, I think when we all say we're looking and trying to develop and decide what our critical needs are, you have to talk to the people. And when we talk about stakeholders, you know, describe a little bit about who the stakeholders are.
Yeah, for sure. And it's not that I have to talk to people. It's I get to talk to people.
There you go.
My favorite part of my job is talking to people about water. So the way that we are going about this is a couple different approaches. Number one is showing up at relevant regional and local meetings. So watershed collaborative groups. We just had the Idaho Water Users Association annual convention last week. So I was there all week. And in those settings, you can have quick one-on-one conversations with a whole range of folks. So last week, it was a bunch of irrigators and water users, water lawyers, technical experts from different consulting firms that work on these really complex problems. So there's a lot of different ways to show up to where people are already gathering and learn from those spaces what people are seeing as big challenges and where research opportunities are. But then the other way that we do this is through a really structured process. And that's by engaging with our research advisory committee. So the research advisory committee currently has about 32 members, and they represent industry, nonprofits, municipalities, our state agencies, our federal colleagues, faculty at all three of the research universities, the tribes, and, you know, a handful of other different folks that I probably forgot. But the real role of that research advisory committee is to generate ideas, go back to the groups that they represent and make sure that we're capturing all the research needs and then help prioritize those research opportunities. And so last year, the research advisory committee helped generate over 90 research ideas that could be addressed through IWERI and with collaboration with faculty. And then they whittled it down and prioritized about 16 projects that were accepted by our executive board. And so IWERI's executive board is another way to make sure that we're responding to state needs. And we have the director of the Idaho Water Users Association, so making sure that we understand agricultural needs, the director of IDWR and DEQ, and a handful of other folks that represent different flavors of stakeholders in the state. And so the executive board is really the one that determines how we're moving forward with funding and making sure that we're really addressing the needs of the state.
So you're tuned in to where those needs are. I'm sure various stakeholders in different geographies of the state have slightly different nuanced, focus points. Could you talk about, let's raise some of those needs. Like, what are some of the top three, let's say, needs that come up over and over again?
Yeah, for sure. So there's actually, I would say, there's two flavors of work that we're focusing on right now that came out of that prioritization process. One of them is actually statewide topics. And so topics that you hear in a lot of different individual communities. And so you're like, oh, this community in Southern Idaho is dealing with this issue. A community in North Idaho is dealing with this issue. What if we create a research agenda that addresses this statewide? And so as an example on one of those statewide priorities is, you know, what are the water quality implications of using recycled water or injected water for recharge? And so there's a lot of questions about this. And we're going to be working with our colleagues at the state agencies to kind of identify what are the best practices? What are the best ways to analyze the data? How do you make sure that you're communicating these approaches to make sure that folks understand that their drinking water is safe? And so that's an example of a project that's actually relevant across the state. Then we also have regional projects. And right now on that priority list, there's about, you know, 2 to 3 projects in each region of the state. So up in North Idaho, there's a lot of concern and interest on how Lake Ponderé is being managed to make sure that lake levels are high enough so that they can have their full recreation season up there, which influences the local economy, as you might imagine, and has been, I think there's going to be a new report on that coming from University of Idaho here shortly. There's also some questions about water quality in some of those single source aquifers up north, like the Rathdrum Perry. And then down here in Southern Idaho, as you might imagine, there's a lot of questions around water quantity. And so in Eastern Idaho, as many folks are probably have maybe hopefully heard about, in 2024, the surface water users and the groundwater users came to a new mitigation agreement on how to maintain and sustain water levels in East Snake Plain Aquifer and make sure that the senior water users remain whole. And a big component of that work is understanding, you know, the actual hydrology of the system. Where do different activities impact certain reaches of the river that are really important for downstream water users? And so a lot of our research questions in the East Snake Plain are around how do we improve our hydrologic understanding of that system and how do we decrease gaps in our understanding or uncertainty in certain components of the water budget. And so as an example, one of the faculty here at U of I that has a faculty funded project is looking at consumptive use in the East Snake Plain. And you have lots of different approaches to modeling evapotranspiration, but he's like doing a deep dive to say, here are a bunch of different products. These are the ones that have the least uncertainty in them. And this is our suggestion on how we move forward with it. But then one of the projects that I think I'm most excited about is, so this past year, we are allocated $1 million in funding from the legislature. And part of the expectation or requirement of that funding is that we distribute funds across all three universities. And so we had faculty apply for that funding, and then we've now distributed almost $600,000 in research funds out to faculty at all three universities. And one of the projects is actually a collaboration between all three universities on one project, which is really cool. And that project is looking at our weather and climate monitoring network across the state. And so we call that the hydrometeorological network or a hydromet network. And so you could think about all the places that we are monitoring precipitation and temperature. And one of the challenges with these kind of monitoring networks is that you have to be able to access them to work on them. But we also have this very mountainous terrain in a lot of the state. And so we know that our current network has a lot of gaps and that we have a lot of uncertainty in precipitation estimates, as an example. And so this project is looking at our whole network across all the different agencies that do these kind of measurements, and we'll be providing information on where our biggest gaps are and where the opportunities are in the future to expand this monitoring network. And so that's another example of a project that's relevant across the whole state.
So could you explain a little bit about how our water table and reserves work kind of throughout the whole year? You know, why should we be concerned about what's happening now versus what's going to be happening at the end of July or first part of August?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different components of how this works. But number one, if we think big picture about the water cycle, is that inputs into the water budget, which is kind of like your bank account, like if you had a bank budget, inputs are precipitation in rain or snow. And then you have these kind of couple of different buckets of storage that we like to talk about. One is the soil profile. So that's anywhere where like trees and vegetation are accessing soil moisture. And then you have like the actual aquifer, which is deeper down type of storage. And so when we have a lot of precipitation in the fall, as an example, that fills up that soil moisture storage zone. And that's really great. It's a really beneficial thing. But the other important part of our storage is actually happening in our snowpack. And so the snowpack is like a piece of storage that's up high in the mountains, and that it slowly comes off through the springtime. And it's kind of like refilling that soil moisture zone, you know, later into the summertime. And then you have your aquifer, which is kind of gives you the idea of like, what's your baseline water budget? Like how much water is really down there total? And so in the East Snake Plain, as an example, we saw that from around the 1950s or so, the aquifer levels were declining. So groundwater levels were declining. So folks that have their own domestic well might see changes in their water levels that are annual. So it's like in the summertime, their well levels might go lower. That's from all the vegetation that's using the water. But over time, they like stay kind of static. Versus you can say like, oh, if the water levels are declining over a course of a decade, then you have, then your water budget is in the negative. And you don't want that, just like your bank account. And then, so the other thing I think that's important to think about with snowpacks as a storage component is that when you don't have snowpack, then you don't have a way to supply water late in the season. And so that immediately makes us think about fire season. If you don't have a good snowpack, then all of a sudden it's really dry in August and you have more likelihood of having fires, as an example. And obviously that's a big stressor for agricultural producers as well.
Well, so this year, you know, we're recording this in late January of 2026. And so far, this is an unusual year, to say the least, in terms of probably temperature and precipitation as snow, anyway, that we've seen in the Pocatello area, I'm sure in Boise, similar story. And we don't, you know, we don't know what February and March and April are going to bring in terms of snow delivery in the mountains. But how concerned should we be at this stage here at the beginning of 2026?
I think there are a lot of folks that are quite concerned and very hopeful that it could change. If we get a lot of snow in February and March, which isn't out of the question, right, then maybe we'll be okay and we'll have an average water year. If we don't get snow in the next couple of months, we could be rolling into one of the lowest stream flow years on record in some basins. I think in last week in the Oahe, it was like the lowest recorded snowpack in 83 years. And so when I think about concerns with that, so one thing is that our snowpack high in the mountains is actually about average. It's our low elevation snowpack that effectively isn't there.
Yeah.
That low elevation snowpack is what either it never came because it was falling as rain because it was too warm, or it fell as snow, but then melted very quickly because it was too warm. And so that low elevation snow early in the season is usually kind of the first thing that's running off into the streams. And if that doesn't exist, if that's not there early in the season, then when your high elevation snow starts melting, it's just filling that storage bucket underneath of where that low elevation snow would have been and would have filled up the soil profile. And so I think most folks are pretty concerned right now and really hopeful that maybe the conditions will change.
I'm curious how much, you know, how sensitive is the system to one winter's snow levels as opposed to thinking about it on multiple years? So if you had like, if a year ago and 2 years ago was a really good snow year, but then we had a very lean year, do you feel that immediately in the summer, or is there a longer wave, I guess, averaging that happens in terms of snow release and water in the budget?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's a little bit different between every basin. Some basins respond a lot quicker than others. So for example, I've done a lot of work in the Big Wood River Basin, and they see it in about a 2-year cycle. So
okay.
if you have a good water year last year and this year was a little bit lean, like maybe you're still kind of okay. But I think the really big one is if you have multiple years of low water. Or as an example, in 2025, in the 2025 water year, there was no there was very little precipitation in the fall. And so the system was really dry in the fall. That soil profile was really dry. And then you had average snowpack, but then you had a low water year because of that dry fall. And so if you follow that up with another low water year, your system, like year over year, if you're not filling it back up, you're going to have more and more negative effects as you go down the line. If you have a really big water year and then you have a dry year, the system's kind of like buffered a little bit.
Okay.
And we saw that in 2017, the snowpocalypse, is that the whole system got supercharged, and that can like hold things over for a year or so. So last year wasn't a great snow year, or it wasn't a great stream flow year, but I think some of the reservoirs came in looking okay in the fall. All the precipitation that we did get in the fall added some water into a lot of the reservoirs, so that looks okay. So that's one of the silver linings that folks at the NRCS and the Bureau have kind of highlighted, is that we're coming into the season not looking too terrible. But if we had a couple of years of this back-to-back, the impacts of that would start to get larger.
So kind of at present, what is our water demand, our water usage? And if we look back 5, 10, 20 years, you know, as you're talking about our water tables and reservoirs recharging, as water demand increases, it's obvious that it'll take more time for our water tables to rebound from low years. Is our demand for water in Idaho drastically increasing, or have we kind of plateaued on that?
That's a great question, and it's actually part of the research that we are actively doing right now. And so as an example, again, in the East Snake Plain, just because it's a good example, is that some of the work that we are doing is to kind of shore up that water budget so we can really look at which things are changing through time. Is it that water demand is increasing, or is it that water supply from the mountains is declining? So you could get to the same outcome by a couple different directions. And iWERI, our staff scientists and faculty that are leading some of these projects, are really digging into some of these questions. There are some products from the USGS that calculate water demand through time. I haven't dug into them. They were just released this past year, and you'd have to go basin by basin. It depends based on the basin. You would expect in places where agriculture is declining and we have more urban water use or urban land cover, that maybe your water demand as a whole might slowly decline. But as you change those land uses, you're also changing inputs into the system. And so when you have agriculture, you have incidental recharge back into the aquifer from their irrigation practices. And when you move into an urban landscape, you lose a lot of that recharge back into the system. There's some interesting complex dynamics that are happening there. And I am hopeful that in the next year of the research that we're doing, we'll be able to start answering that question in some key basins. And we know that, you know, the Palouse Basin, as an example, their water demand has actually been declining over time due to a bunch of conservation activities that they've been doing. So they have been working with the university across over into the Oregon side of things to be like, okay, how can we reuse our water, implement conservation practices? And despite having increased population growth, their water demand is actually kind of leveling off. So that's where the example of it depends on each watershed. And the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee is doing some great work up there to help shore that up.
You mentioned before about the idea of recycled water or recharging aquifers with recycled water. Could you give an example of what that might look like?
Yeah. So there's actually a really great example in Nampa. They worked with a local irrigation district to basically they created a new recycled water plant where they are taking water that's already been used, cleaning it back up, to a really high quality. And then they're putting that water, once it's recycled, back into an irrigation canal so that irrigators downstream have more water available at the times of year that they need it the most. And there's a lot of different ways that recycled water works. So in California, a lot of recycled water locations like are actually being used for drinking water. So you can, rather than just putting the water back into the stream and going downstream, you can actually reuse it for a variety of uses. I believe at Micron, you know, on the industrial scale, they're recycling water that's being used so that they can continue to use it on site for their industrial purposes. And then another way that you can use recycled water is to clean the water and then put it in a recharge basin or an injection well back into the subsurface. And so that's one way to, you know, the state is doing a lot of managed aquifer recharge projects across the state to try to help shore up our groundwater levels. And using recycled water is one of the ways that we could do that.
Well, that's really interesting. I want to get to our trivia question because I know you have some, you can expand on this. Could you tell us a little bit about the day of the year that the water year starts?
Yes, this is a great question and a key part of being a water nerd. So the water year starts on October 1st. And the reason why, you know, I'll have to dig in and find out who decided this and when, but the reason why we use October 1 kind of as a good baseline is that you have finished the summer season and you're not getting, you know, you're kind of in that transition before winter time when you're starting to accumulate snow. So October 1 is about when you're like, okay, we can pause and see how things ended at the end of the irrigation season, at the end of the summer. And, you know, the trees are starting to chill out. And then after October 1, you're watching the precipitation accumulate in the watershed. And so this works really well in mountain watersheds across the western United States, where our snowpack starts falling, ideally in November. And then by the end of October, you can kind of see like about how much water came through the system.
So October 1st, and are there celebrations that happen in the water among water scientists?
Again, only if you are the coolest water nerds do you celebrate the water year. So I know at Boise State, Jim McNamara used to do a hog roast for the water year. It's a good way to get a bunch of the students, you know, new grad students excited about the upcoming school year. I've heard that Sarah Godsey also has a water year celebration. We had one this year here in Boise at Lost Grove. And so it's a fun time for us to get together and socialize and get excited about.
Well, and celebrate the thing that unites us, right? The right. Water. We all need it.
Yeah. Raise our glass of water.
That's right.
Raise our eighth glass of water to celebrate. Yeah. All right, Kendra, thank you so much for joining us again. And for those who'd like to learn more about Idaho's water, please visit the Idaho Water Resource Research Institute website, which is iwrri.uidaho.edu. And again, thank you, Kendra.
Thank you.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Shows are produced at KISU Studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University, with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at kisu.org, from Spotify or other select podcast services, or from KISU's mobile app. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noid-kisu@isu.edu.